Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Don't forget to follow us on our Facebook page, Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends.
Or on Twitter at Broadway Curtain.
And on Instagram at Broadway Curtain.
Welcome to Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. I'm Rob Schneider.
And I'm Kevin David Thomas.
Our guest this week is no stranger to Broadway audiences. Not only did she win the 1990 Tony Award for her brilliant performance as not one, but two other women in City of Angels, she broke their hearts night after night as the first Fantine on Broadway.
As if that wasn't enough, she was also seen in such shows as A, My Name is Alice, a class act, Laughter on the 23rd Floor, and Moon Over Buffalo.
To tell us what it was like to get rewrites from Neil Simon, comedy lessons from Carol Burnett, and to sing one of the greatest Cy Coleman songs ever written, here is Randy Graff.
Hi, guys.
Hi, Randy. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm a living legend. I should have a fur.
We'll get you a fur. Actually, Randy's not wearing a fur today. Can you tell us what you are wearing in honor of
Broadway
Con?
I just came from Broadway Con where we did a Les Mis panel, and I'm actually wearing, I wish you could see it, it's the original Fantine locket. And it's very old. It kept breaking. They never got me a new one. So they just kept stitching this one up so it's filled with tape and
wire.
But this is the first time I'm wearing it in 30 years. And I thought, wear it for Broadway Con. And they all gasped when I brought it out.
I did too.
It's very cool.
It's kind of funky fashionable, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
And
it works perfectly with
the
ensemble.
Right?
Oh,
yeah. Thank you, boys.
Yeah, it's very 1800s. It's very French chic.
Now forget that fur jacket on you. Everything's going to look great.
Retro chic.
Retro chic.
Indeed.
Where in Brooklyn did you grow up?
Canarsie.
Canarsie?
That's how I used to talk. To talk like that. And then my friends told me if I wanted to go into the theater, I had to learn how to speak. But I used to talk like this. And when I'm with my parents, I always talk like this because, you know, you just go back into the accent. I had no R's in my
Canarsie.
Now it's Canarsie. Before it was Canarsie.
Canarsie.
You're fancy now. You got real fancy.
I have R's.
Was your family in show business?
Yes. Mm. Actually, the Graff cousins. It all started with Uncle Jerry Graff, my dad's brother, was a musical director and an arranger for the Barry sisters and the Nat King. He was one of the original Pied Pipers. He was the musician in the family. And whenever the Graff cousins would get together for Passover or, you know, whatever the holiday was, we would always sing. So we came up with it in the family. And my cousin Todd was in Baby on Broadway. Now he's directing. He directed, you know, Camp.
Yeah.
But no, there was always singing in the family. All the cousins sang. My cousin Eileen is a Broadway girl. And now Eileen's daughter Nika Graff Lanzaroni is in the Broadway community, so it's all over the place.
Yeah, indeed.
I came up that way.
Did you get a chance to go into New York and see shows while you were growing up in Canarsie?
The very first Broadway show I ever saw when I was about 8, 10 was Fiddler. I went to see Fiddler on the Roof. That was my first Broadway show.
Do you remember who your Tevye was? Was it?
It wasn't Zero. I think it was Harry Goss.
Oh, okay.
But the Graffs were not experienced, sophisticated theater goers. So we went on a matinee and we were in a diner. Was it at the Winter Garden? I don't remember.
Yeah, I think Fiddler was at the Winter Garden.
We were at a diner and it was like 2:00 and we were nowhere near the lobby and nobody was outside and somebody noticed, maybe we should. And we walked in, I think, around 2:15 or something. It was after 2. We still hadn't got in. We walked in into our seats in the front mezz during Matchmaker. We walked in.
Oh.
Walked in during, because we missed tradition. We missed the opening number. But I actually turned to my dad. I was such a kid. I turned to my dad. I said, that's okay, Daddy. We'll stay again to the part we came in on. I thought it was like a movie.
It was like going to the,
I thought it was a loop. Like a movie. But it has such meaning for me because that was my first show. It's my favorite musical. And then I played Zeitel, at Pittsburgh Public Theater. I played Zeitel right before Les Mis.
Yeah.
And then the 2004 revival, I played Golda.
Wow.
So
you got them all.
Wow. Yeah, everybody but Grandma Zeitel.
Yeah,
Tevye maybe in a couple of years.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed. Get you down to the Muni and it'll be Tevye.
That's right.
What were any other shows you saw growing up besides Fiddler?
When I was in college, my mom took me to a preview of Seesaw. I didn't know anything about Cy Coleman. at that point. But all I remember was listening to her and watching her sing Nobody Does It Like Me. And I related to her because she was this Jewish girl from the Bronx who just kept screwing things up. And I was this Jewish girl from Brooklyn who just kept screwing things up. So I just watched her. That moment was seminal for me.
Yeah.
That was the moment that I actually pictured myself singing on a Broadway stage when I heard that song.
That's when you were like, this is it.
This is it. This is what I want to do. Sing Michelle Lee, sing Nobody Does It Like Me. And you know, the total irony of it is You Can Always Count on Me. The prototype for that song is Nobody Does It Like Me. And at my callback for City of Angels, which was the first time I met Cy Coleman, he asked me to sing Nobody Does It Like Me. You know, he hadn't written Count on Me yet, but he knew that it was a song about self-deprecating humor. Mm-hmm. And he said, do you know this song called Nobody Does It Like Me? And I said, oh, my God, do I know that song? I said, but I haven't sung it in a while, and I don't remember the lyrics. And he said, don't worry, I'll yell them out to you. So I started.
This is in the callback.
This is at the callback on stage at the then Virginia, now the August Wilson.
That's
He was, he just was out in the house, and he kept calling the words out to me, and it gradually started to come back. He made his way onto the stage behind the piano and finished the song with me. I went home. An hour later, I got the call.
Were you active in theater in high school?
Not so much in high school. We did something in Brooklyn called Sing, which is what Glee is kind of based
on. Sing! Exclamation mark!
Sing! Where we would create shows, original shows, and put in music of the time. So I was writing them, and it was a competition between the sophomores, the juniors, and the seniors. So I was the lead in sophomore Sing, and then we moved to Staten Island, and I tried to get a Sing started. Uh-huh. They didn't know; they thought I was crazy.
Yeah.
But I kept going back to help write Junior Sing, but not really. I didn't start doing parts until college.
Yeah. What kind of music did you listen to growing up, though?
Streisand.
Yeah, well, another Brooklyn lady. Yeah, of course.
I listened to her. I have a show called Made in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
That's all the songs in the show are written by people who were born in Brooklyn.
What a great idea.
Either written by or made famous by people born in Brooklyn. And I tell a whole story about Barbara Streisand and how she influenced me and what it was like singing I Dreamed a Dream for her when she came to see Les Mis.
Oh, I bet that was an important moment in your life.
Yeah. Nerve-wracking.
Yeah.
And thrilling, and also kind of comforting, because, and I tell this story in my act, the lights went down, and of course they ushered her in the dark so nobody would know she was there, and she was in the fifth row on the aisle.
Mm-hmm.
And you see, that was my Brooklyn accent that just came out.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
On the aisle.
Mm-hmm. On the aisle.
That's what happens when I talk about Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. I just go right there. But fifth row on the aisle, and she was wearing a pink Angora beret.
Oh,
I remember
gosh.
This. And she was all kind of cuddled, not sitting regularly, and just kind of cuddled up. And I came out. I scoped her at the a little bit at the beginning. And then I came out. And when you sing I Dreamed a Dream in that production, you're really, really downstage.
Mm-hmm.
And she was so close to me. And I sang it. And somewhere in the middle, I just calmed down because I realized that I had this quiet confidence about me, because I realized that deep down underneath all of her fame, she was just a Jewish girl from Brooklyn.
That's right.
So I was able to calm down and sing the song. But then in Act Two, in the Barricades, every Fontaine has to play a boy at the Barricades,
right? Yeah, so Bullet Boy. Mm-hmm.
Because the actors didn't have any lines because it was so noisy on stage from the cannons and the music, and they used to turn the actors' mics off.
Mm-hmm.
So our company used to yell out things that had absolutely nothing to do
like
with the revolution.
Do. Like you do.
Just like, I'm calling in sick next week! Meet me at Kodama after the matinee! That's how we used to blow off a little steam. So I would yell out, Barbara Streisand! Do you hear the people sing? We're the luckiest people in the world! That's how I communicated with her. Never met her.
She didn't come back.
Shouting her name on the barricades.
Talk to Pierre. Oh, man.
How could she not talk to Pierre? That's an insult.
She had the beret on, too, that day. I mean.
I know. She was you know, do you think that's why she wore the beret?
You know, I was saying it because she was going to the French musical.
She was in the beret.
I like that. Now, before Les Mis, there was Sarava.
When we broke the glass at my wedding, I had everybody yell, Sarava. That's a true story. Sarava was the very first role I created on Broadway. Rosalia. Rosalia. And I named her Rosalia Felcha because I was the sister to Tova Felcha. So Rosalia Felcha, and I was ecstatic. I was making $430 a week. Nice. It was my first big Broadway thing. We never opened. We never officially opened.
You never officially opened?
You were in previews.
No, we previewed for 5 months.
Perpetual previews. Wow.
And the only reason I knew we had opened was because I walked through the stage door. Eventually, critics started coming in. Eventually, they started to come in. Mm-hmm. I walked through the stage door, and there was a big basket of bright red, delicious apples. And the stage doorman said to me, "Well, I guess we opened. We got the apples from Joe Allen. I guess we opened." Joe Allen's restaurant it was a tradition to send every Broadway show that was opening a basket of delicious red apples. So I walked in, there was a big bath. I guess we opened. That was Sarava.
What was this about?
It had a book by N. Richard Nash, who wrote The Rainmaker, with music by Mitch Lee, God rest his soul, who told us that our show was a tax shelter for his La Mancha tour.
No way.
Now, I was young and naive, and we were all standing on the stage. We were all standing on the stage opening, and he said, "You guys better run because you're a tax shelter for my La Mancha tour." Like half laughing, and I looked around. What did I know?
Yeah.
I looked around at all of the gypsies, and they were all just like rolling their eyes.
Oh,
but yes.
Oh, my
so
God.
It didn't matter that we didn't make any money. But the crazy thing is we had a commercial that played like 24/7.
I was going to ask you about that.
Well, that commercial finally got us an audience, and we built a real bridge and tunnel audience towards the end of the run. We were packed towards the end of the run from that commercial that ran 24/7. This is Donna Floor. Would you like to hear some of the words to Sarava?
Actually, I was hoping you were going to say that or sing some too. I mean,
when I do a nightclub act, I'm going to do a really slow version of Sarava because it's very moving. And it goes a little something like this. Sarava, Sarava, Sarava means hello friend, I'm glad you're here. Sarava, Sarava, Sarava means that the coffee trees are full of beans this year. All the cinnamon trees are brighter and the coconut milk is whiter. Life is good, knock on wood, Sarava Bridge. Take my hand and we'll go far. Shall we dance from star to star? Join the band. That's right, maracas.
Yeah, I'm feeling it. I can feel the orchestration now.
And take a spin or something. No, 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 no. Come on in and sing this song. Here's my favorite. Sarava. Making me choke. Sarava. Here we go. Sarava means we are lovers. What's your name? Sarava. Sarava. Have a hug, a kiss. It's all for free. What's yours? I'll have the same. If the world's going up in powder, then we better start singing louder. Sarava. 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 Now.
The world goes up in power.
Then we better start singing louder. They couldn't hear us. The band was so loud. We used to sing salad bar, Saravan. It became the joke of the industry. Everything was Sarava, Sarava, Sarava. My husband, who's a pianist, was subbing The Secret Garden at the time. Mm-hmm. He was learning the book to The Secret Garden. And the very last page of the book, the very last note, it says, Sarava.
That's hysterical. That's hysterical.
I'd love to know how and why. Wow.
So you never really opened. How long was the show at the Mark Hellinger? For a couple of months?
Oh, another good story about that. Mm-hmm. And a couple of months, and then they moved us to the Broadway. And our last day at the Broadway, I was standing on the fire escape with PJ Benjamin, and I was looking at the signs intersecting that said 52nd and Broadway, and I thought to myself, when am I ever going to be here again? And 8 years later, I was doing Les Mis there.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Do you remember when you were auditioning, what was your audition song? Did you have a standard What was it?
Nobody Does It Like Me.
That was the standard.
That was the standard audition You're song, and I got lost in his arms.
That was your ballad.
Yeah. That was my ballad. I used to do Murder, He Says by Frank Lesser,
and I
Wish I Didn't Love You So. Those two songs together. There was a show called Perfectly Frank that was a Frank Lesser review, and I didn't get the show, but I got two great songs because we had to learn Frank Lesser songs. So Murder, He Says, and I Wish I Didn't Love You So were my two. And then in the late 80s when I auditioned for Les Mis, Where Is the Warmth from Baker's Wife, that was I Dreamed a Dream of Its Time. Everybody was singing that.
It's a good one.
It's such a beautiful. Good one. Yeah. It's a beautiful song. All you singing actresses out there, forget Meadowlark. Everybody does Meadowlark. Yeah. Take a look at Where Is the Warmth. It's beautiful. If you ever have to audition for Fontaine, sing Where Is the Warmth.
Yeah, I hardly ever play it. It's great advice. No, people don't bring it in. I very rarely play it.
It's gorgeous. Yeah. It's gorgeous.
It's true.
It's a great score. Baker's Wife was just a great score. Mm-hmm. So,
isn't it crazy that Stephen Schwartz has never won a Tony? Isn't that crazy?
That is crazy.
Yes.
That is
and from 71 or 70 to now, I mean, like Pippin, you know, Godspell, like, come
Magic
on.
Show. Like,
well done,
Rags.
Sir. Well done.
Just Rags. The score to Rags is
so
fantastic.
So good. So good.
We were just talking about it at Broadway Con because Joanna Gluschak was in Rags right before she went into Les Mis with us.
Oh,
and
really?
I went to see it with her and Terry Mann and Judy Kuhn, the three of them went from Rags to Les Mis.
Oh, God, what a good show.
What was your audition like? Do you recall auditioning for Trevor and John?
Oh, I was just talking about it at Broadway Con. Well, these guys, you know, Trevor and John, they were interested in actors.
Yes.
Serious actors. Our company was, they were great singers, but they were focused on the acting in the audition. So when I sang Where Is the Warmth, they called me back, and then I had to learn I Dreamed a Dream. Mm-hmm. And I was a nervous wreck. Mm-hmm. Everybody wanted to be in Les Mis.
Yeah.
I was a nervous wreck. No matter how much I rehearsed it, I was a nervous wreck. And so I started to sing and crack on every single, but there are dreams, they're going to be crack. So different now from what it seemed, crack, crack, crack. And I stopped my audition. I said, there were 13 people behind the panel, all the designers, Cameron McIntosh, everybody. It was high pressure.
It's intimidating.
So,
yeah.
Intimidating, nerve-wracking. So I stopped my audition, and I said, I'm sorry, I'm just so nervous. And Trevor Nunn came out from the panel, and he took me over to the side, and he said so gently, we don't care about singing. We've heard you sing. I just want to see you have a nervous breakdown as Fantine. That's what I want to see. I want to see you have a nervous breakdown. And so I took my shoes off. I got down on the floor, and I sang it like, just spilled my guts out, cracking all over the place, but they didn't care.
Wow.
They were concerned about the acting. That's all they, you know, we were just talking about this. They bonded the company by doing improvisational exercises. Lots. Did you do improvs with your company?
Yes.
It was like being in college again.
Oh, yeah. But there's something youthful and fun about it, too. It levels the playing field, and then all of a sudden...
Absolutely.
And they're always about, especially Trevor, is all about company. It's about everyone's together.
Yes.
One. It's the RSC kind of thing, right?
Absolutely. That's what they did for Nicholas Nickleby.
Yes.
As a matter of fact, I used to tell my friends, I feel like I'm doing Nicholas Nickleby with a turntable. That's
they just come off of that, hadn't they? So it
was, they had. Yeah. So it was... So we did all these...
the turntable, yes.
Right?
Yeah, totally.
So we did all these improvs. Did you do the famous prostitution exercises? Did you do those?
No.
Everybody always perks up at those.
No.
Everything that we did was an improv that led into the scene because they did not want to replicate the British company. They wanted a new company from
New
York.
That's great. Mm-hmm.
So it all came out of improvisation, and we didn't delve into the text for like a week.
Wow.
And...
the
prostitution exercises was they split up the company, boys, you know, men and women. John Caird took the women into one room, and Trevor Nunn took them. Look, we did the prostitution exercises for him, and whenever he wasn't around, Trevor would say, "Oh, John, he must be doing the prostitution exercises with the women." But this is what we had to do. He sat in front of us. We had to walk across in one by one. We had to walk across the room as a prostitute from 19th century France. And the women of that time were sickly. Losing limbs. Yes.
Teeth, no teeth.
On their deathbeds, some of them. Drug addicts, you know, in really bad shape. So we had to walk across the room and seduce John with the one part of our bodies that still felt beautiful. That was our exercise. And then after we were done, we came into the room with the boys and did the same thing to the boys and had to seduce them. And the boys were told, they're going to come in and you are just going to respond to them however you respond to them in the moment. So in the lovely ladies scene, each sailor picks a certain woman.
Yes.
And that came out of the prostitution exercise.
Wow. What a great way of working. What a collaborative way of working.
To this day, it was the most thrilling rehearsal period of my life.
Yes.
And we did did you do the cartoon exercise?
What was that?
The cartoon character exercise. This is the one that truly bonded the company. This was the exercise that they used. There was a method to the madness. They used it to make us feel foolish and humiliated. Although some people enjoyed it, we had to do our favorite cartoon character, mm-hmm. just do a little vignette for the entire company. And there were Betty Boops and there were olive oils and I felt so ridiculous and everybody was so nervous to do it, but they did it to make us feel foolish and to make us take risks and feel comfortable in front of one another. And then we did the typical college exercises where, you know, you had to be part of a machine. We had to fall into each other's arms for trust. We really bonded. And it was through these exercises. And even when we were in D.C., the transition into Paris Beggars mm-hmm. hadn't been staged yet. And that came out of an improv.
Wow.
And they put it in our company. And they went back to London and put it in the London company.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
We created lots of stuff.
Yeah.
What a cool way of working. Because, you know, it's been around for so long, you assume that it's always been this finely tuned machine.
Yes.
And to hear that it's so organic. And on your production, they were doing similar
and
things,
right?
And then
the 10th anniversary, when John Caird came back, they got rid of all staging for the ensemble. And they called it Free Les Mis. And the whole idea was, if you stay out of the way of the story, but whatever you do on stage, you can do three different things every single night. And it was about just keeping it fresh and real.
That's
and so
great.
You could pick a different lady and lovely ladies every single night, you know, depending on where you felt. But I give them credit, both those guys, for always keeping a show that could easily be a machine. So and started at day one. That's incredible.
Yeah.
Absolutely incredible to me.
I loved working with
and
them.
And the trust that they had this huge hit in Europe and said, even though it's going to be a whole new... You know, they could have easily imposed.
It was a hit with the people. It was not a critical hit.
But audiences love it.
But it was the people's show.
Love it.
And you know the story about Les Mis, how the words Les Mis came about?
No,
because
I don't.
Cab drivers in London couldn't pronounce Les Miserables. So if somebody wanted to go, they'd say, you want to see Les Miserables?
Uh-uh.
You know? You want to see Les Miserables, you know? So they started, so they named it Les Mis so that the cab drivers could...
I didn't
communicate with their passengers.
I have never heard that. That's
this
amazing.
Is the truth. They told us that.
I like that.
Now, before Les Mis, my name is Alice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Tell us about this.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that was fun. That was fun. That was the woman's lib review. And the people who were responsible for some of the material went on to do incredible things. Well, Marta Kaufman, David Crane went on to create Friends and other shows. Mm-hmm. Michael Skloff, who was our musical director, wrote the theme song to Friends. Richard LeGravenis wrote a piece for it, who wrote all these wonderful screenplays, Fisher King, and most recently, last 5 years.
Yeah.
Anne Mira was a contributor. And it was five ladies, and we did it at the top of the gate. And it was empowering. It was the first show that I was in that was all women,
mm-hmm.
and it was a review, and it was a '90s show. It's really outdated now, but it was, you know, Emily the MBA. That was one of the. It was just the career woman's show.
But you and where was the top of the gate? Where was that located?
The Village Gate is no longer. It was on Bleecker Street.
Hmm.
A lot of shows started there. Scrambled Feet, Jacques Brel is Alive and Well.
Oh, yeah.
But we started at the American Place Theater, which is now Roundabout's Laura Pell's Theater.
Oh, okay.
We started down there in the basement, and we were reviewed really favorably, mm-hmm. super favorably by Frank Rich. And so they moved us to the top of the gate. We had a really nice long run there. Jack A. Harry was an understudy. Yeah. Tanya Pinkins.
Oh my gosh.
Polly Penn. Yeah. Yeah, these were understudies who moved
these
up.
These were the understudies. Wow. That's incredible.
Yeah.
How long were you with A, My Name is Alice for?
Well, I don't know.
Do you remember?
Not close to a year.
Close
maybe,
to a year.
Maybe 9 months.
And then the audition came for Les Mis?
No, then I left that show to do something called Amateur.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
Written by Winnie Holtzman.
Oh, yeah.
Wicked's yeah. Winnie Holtzman. That's the first time I met Winnie. And I did that at, that's when I met Lonnie Price.
Oh.
And we did this show called Amateurs, which later became Birds of Paradise.
Oh.
With J.K. Simmons and Donna Murphy and all these incredible people.
I did not know that.
But it was called Amateurs. We did it at the Cincinnati Playhouse. And it was shepherded. Blah, blah, blah. Shepherded by Arthur Lawrence.
Oh,
so the first time I auditioned was for Arthur Lawrence was for this show called Amateurs, and he was kind of brilliant.
Was he?
One of my go-to audition songs was Where or When.
Mm-hmm.
So I sang Where or When for him, and he said, "Very good, very good." You know, I sang it kind of traditionally, romantically, and he said, "Let's give it a different angle. I want you to sing it like you've just been in a coma, woken up from a coma, and there's a man standing before you, and you have no idea who it is." And it completely changes. It changes the song into a comedy number.
Wow.
"It seems we stood and talked, like, but I can't remember." Where. It turns into a whole different number.
How brilliant.
Yeah.
And did he direct you then in Amateurs?
No, he just was overseeing it because it came out of NYU Graduate Musical Theater Lab.
Right. Oh, okay.
Writing program.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. And it was you and Lonnie.
Greg Edelman.
And Greg Edelman.
Donna Bullock.
Wow.
Wow.
Blah, 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 blah.
Is there a recording? Remember. I feel like
only the Birds of,
the Birds of Paradise.
Only Birds of Paradise has a recording.
Meredith
okay.
Peel, Donna mm-hmm. Murphy.
Oh my gosh.
Barbara Walsh.
What a great group
JK,
of people.
JK, yeah.
So then after that comes Les Mis. And all of that stuff is that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, after that, I think it was Fiddler and then Les Mis. Yeah.
Fiddler at Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh
Civic
Life
with
Opera.
Kevin McCullum? Is that right?
Yes. I think he played the constable or something like that. and Kathleen, Rob Marshall and Kathleen Marshall were connected to it. Amazing.
Wow. That's incredible. That's really incredible. That's when like CLO was doing.
I think Robbie was one of the dancers in it.
Oh yeah,
probably.
I don't think Kathleen was in it, but she was around because they were still living at home. Kevin might have been the constable.
Oh,
Kevin McCullough.
We got constable.
Fiddler on the Roof.
That is acting career.
I love
for
it.
Sure.
And then something very cool, singing on Donahue.
Yeah. We're in that green room for that show. It was like the bar scene in Star Wars because we were all in our costumes. Laurie Beachman, you know, rest in peace. She was there as Grisabella. I was there as, and we were all in our costumes at eight in the morning.
And who was on this panel? Do you remember who was the theater episode, mm-hmm. right?
It was a theater episode, but I always confuse it with the City of Angels panel. Mm. Because the City of Angels panel was Neil Simon and Robert Morse and Jackie Mason and the writer from Time Magazine, I want to say. But I don't remember the panel. It was a theater panel for Les Mis as well.
Yeah,
I don't remember.
I
confused them.
And what I find so interesting on the panel is it's, I think, if I'm remembering correctly, it's Joe Papp,
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. And Jackie Mason, mm-hmm. and I think Neil Simon. But did they? I think they keep them out on stage while the performers
yes,
come out.
Yes, they were watching us.
So while she's doing I Dreamed a Dream,
watching them watch.
And there's Laurie Beachman, there's, you know, Jackie Mason sitting there yeah. nodding at this cat.
Yeah.
Walking around, which there's I find so, I don't know.
That's
I just
right.
Thought,
so
I
find Neil it so was on the, Neil Simon was on the Les Mis show.
Yes.
With Joe Papp.
Yes.
And
Jackie Mason, who
right and Jackie Mason, what a strange panel!
Oh my God!
He was trying to get him to do Hamlet at the public.
Sure.
Jackie Mason at the great. His Cymbeline is great, so if you get a chance, check that out. And then, how does City of Angels come about?
City of Angels just came about because my agent called and said, I have an audition for you. The show was originally called Double Exposure. Mm. And my agent at the time said, I'm so excited about this. It's Michael Blakemore, who just directed Noises Off. It's Cy Coleman. It's Larry Gelbart. Mm-hmm. I couldn't get seen. I had to fight to get seen. I could not get seen. And my agent just said, just see her. You know, she just effing see her, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Who was your agent, by the way?
Well, at that time, the person who really pushed me to get in was Renee Jeanette, who's, I think, in L.A. now. Mm-hmm. I went to my first audition, which was just in an office in the Minskoff building, and I just read for Michael Blakemore. Hmm. And I got called back on the spot.
Ooh.
And then the callback was in the theater, where back then we were allowed to sing two of our own songs. None
my,
of this,
my,
you
my.
Must like, learn song. They didn't, they weren't giving out
30
songs
pages
from the
of
show.
Sides. And, yeah.
No, none of that. Yeah. I read, I think, two Uli scenes, two Donna scenes. I sang Murder, He Says, and I sang More Than You Know. And then that was when Cy said, you know, before you leave, could you sing Nobody, you know, Nobody Does It Like Me.
Tell me, did City of Angels change a lot from the rehearsal room to when it got on stage?
No.
Really?
Wow. No. That show was so together. I think Larry Gelbart changed maybe three words.
Huh.
I read that script and thought, this is ready to open.
Yeah.
At one point I said, Larry, can I say listen here? Yeah. He said, sure, say listen. Listen, boss, I needed like a hook.
Yeah,
I say,
yeah.
So he let me say there. But there were little cuts in the music. I had a verse in Buddy's song, that Donna had a verse in Buddy's song that was cut.
Yeah.
We really had to focus on the technical aspect of the show. We were in rough shape. Jeez. I mean, in City of Angels, there's a cue, a scenic or a light cue every 20 seconds.
Wow.
And our first 2 weeks of previews, we were a hot mess.
Was there any out-of-town tryout?
No.
You just went right to New York. Wow.
No. And I had friends come and went, I don't know.
Oh, really?
And they, because we hadn't found our rhythm, because scenically, we were a mess. And they tried to, the producers wanted to close us, because they just wanted to get a money maker. They wanted, they wanted to close it. And Michael Blakemore said, over my dead body. And after 2 weeks, the second 2 weeks, we found our groove. And of course, we were the big hit that we were.
Yeah. Yeah.
And won all these Tony Awards, and they closed the show at 80% capacity. Why? Because they wanted Smokey Joe's in there.
Oh, my.
Really?
God. Talk about political.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. I would tell you a funny thing about the staging of the magic behind the quick costume change in the middle of Count On Me from Uli Donna.
Yes.
It came out of the genius of Michael Blakemore.
Uh-huh.
And the song starts with Uli's section. That's all in black and white.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a trench coat on, and I had underneath a gray nightgown. But on the front part of the nightgown, there was a panel of these flowers, black. Because Michael thought, how are we going to make this change as quick as possible for you, costume-wise? And I'll tell you about the scenic change in a minute, but costume-wise, I took off, you know, barking up the wrong damn tree. You can always count on me. Lights out. I had already put my coat while I was singing on the hanger. And these little panels that were in black for the black and white section that came on the V-neck part of the nightgown were snapped on. So I snapped them off and stuck it under the pillow. And underneath the black flowers were brightly colored flowers.
Brilliant.
Genius of Michael Blakemore. Now, while this was happening, I got in the bed, Uli's bed, which turned into Donna's bed. So, and it happened, if it happened in more than, you know, 15 seconds, the moment was gone.
Sure.
So it was rehearsed within an inch of its life. So I would get in the bed, get under the covers so that the stagehands could do what they need to do. The headboard flipped around to color. So the first thing that happened, lights out. The first thing that happened was these, I got under the covers and these two hands from the stagehand would come through the headboard and take the gray from the black and white section, gray blanket, through the headboard. Underneath was a pink colored blanket. And then they flipped everything around. They flipped the lights around. They flipped the headboard around. And when the lights came up, everything was in color, and the audience lost their mind.
Amazing. Ugh.
But but Michael had to figure out it was Michael's idea, because to make it one side of the stage black and white and the other side color. That was not written in. Michael.
Oh, really?
It was not written in. Michael. Wow. That's what Michael wanted to do.
What was it like working with Michael Blakemore?
A dream.
Yeah.
A dream. He's like John Cleese. He's elegant and sophisticated, and he's got a wicked sense of humor. And he would just let you do. He wasn't controlling or micromanaging. He would let you do it, and then he would kind of edit around you or come in to you and say, you know, can you try this. But he knew exactly what he wanted, so he cast really, really well. And I did have a problem with the choreography of You Can Always Count on Me. The choreographer at the time wasn't a minimalist, really. So he had me do it like Shirley MacLaine in If My Friends Could See Me Now. And he had me jump up on the bed at the end. And I asked him why, and he said because it's show business. He didn't understand we're telling a story here.
Right,
you know, we're really telling a story here. So I was in tears because I knew the number was how good it was and that it was being ruined. And I went to Michael in tears and I said, this is what's happening. He said, no, we can't have that. And he directed it.
Wow.
He directed the song from start to finish as a monologue.
And you got a Tony Award. Out of all
this.
I did. It was
and a well-deserved
Tony
Award out of all this.
Thank you. I'm very proud of that award for that role. I really am.
And then after City of Angels, you did Falsettos. You went to Falsettos
for
a little bit.
That has a real history to it. I actually saw Bill Finn this past summer because I did my show at Barrington Stage, and he was there. And right after Les Mis, they did the very first reading of Falsetto Land upstairs at a little theater, tiny, tiny little theater, directed by James Lapine at Playwrights Horizon. Mm-hmm. So I got asked to play Trina at a little reading of, Falsetto Land came after March of the Falsettos.
Yes.
I wasn't in March of the Falsettos.
Okay.
I saw it with the original company. So when Bill Finn wrote Falsetto Land, we did a reading all the way down at West Bank Studio. And I did it with all the original guys from March of the Falsettos. And Mary Testa was in it. And I played Trina in that, in Falsetto Land. When Bill decided to put the two shows together, March of the Falsettos and Falsetto Land, and call it Falsettos, I got called to do a reading of it and to play Trina.
Mm-hmm.
At Playwrights Horizons. This is the hardest show I've ever sung.
Oh, really? Yeah.
It's very hard singing. It's
yeah.
a lot of belting. You really...
Falling to the ground, all that. Yeah, it's just...
Breaking
numbers, down.
Yeah.
And it's constant singing and constant, you know, mixing and flipping and all that stuff into your head voice.
Navigating,
a lot of negotiating in that singing. For me, because I don't sing like Carol Lee Carmelo.
Right.
So for me, I had to negotiate it. So we did that. Yeah. And then when they did Falsettos on Broadway, they had taken a company. They took Barbara Walsh from a company that Graziella Daniel had directed.
Yes, I remember that. Yeah.
But when they replaced her, they just asked me to do it, and I went in and I did it for a month. I actually did it with Mandy Patinkin as Marvin.
Wow.
The Randy and Mandy Show.
Randy and Mandy.
I did it with. He was an intense Marvin.
I
could have.
He was very intense.
Wow.
You had to be careful because you never knew when a menorah was going to fly across the stage. You really he was very on fire and in the moment and absolutely was so present and I loved working with him.
How long were you with it?
Just 10 weeks.
But wow. Still, ooh,
and I went right
intense.
From that into Laughter on the 23rd Floor.
Tell us about Laughter on the 23rd Floor, an original Neil Simon play, Jerry Zaks directing.
Oh, my God.
And a play, not a musical.
I mean,
yeah. It was my first play on Broadway. I had done some regional work, but that was my first play on Broadway. I was working with the funniest men in the world.
Tell us about
it. I just couldn't believe it. I remember we were out of town. And we were at a note session, and I was sitting next to Neil Simon. I just like took a moment to just take this in, take this in right now. I was sitting next to him, and Jerry was giving some notes about a particular line. And I turned to Neil and I said, "You're really funny." And he said, "I hope so." But here's a funny thing about Laughter on the 23rd Floor with Nathan Lane and J.K. Simmons and John Slattery and Mark Lynn Baker, just the funniest, most adorable men in New York. And when we were out of town, the response was, Neil Simon said it was the biggest response he had ever gotten on one of his plays from the audience.
Wow.
As far as laughter is concerned.
Yeah.
And during previews, people were hysterically laughing. And then the review from the New York Times came out that basically said it wasn't funny and that the jokes didn't land. And for about a month, it was like nothing, because that is the power of the printed word. They were told it wasn't funny, and that's how they came in. And it took us about a month to get them back.
How did you get any work done with all of those funny guys?
Jerry Zaks, man.
He cracks
the whip. We got the work done.
What's it like getting directed by Jerry Zaks?
I listen to everything that he says, because when it comes to comedy, nobody directs comedy like Jerry Zaks. And the two most valuable lessons I've ever learned in acting, and I tell him that every time I see him, and he goes, "Oh, darling, that's so nice. But make the positive choice, get to the end of the line. That is Jerry's. Wow. Those are the mantras. Make the positive choice, get to the end of the line. Otherwise, when you don't get to the end of the line, the audience gets ahead of you.
Yes.
In comedy, specifically. And making the positive choice just doesn't mean happy.
Yeah.
What it means is that you make the choice that will open, let's say we're working on a song. For instance, "I Dreamed a Dream" is such a trap in it being a pity party and self-pitying. And with every song, you have to be at a completely different place at the end of the song than you are at the beginning of the song. Mm-hmm. So when students come in with that song and it's just, there's a sameness to it, and just this "feel sorry for me, so my life is terrible, so awful" from the beginning. The opening of that song, "There Was a Time," is just getting yourself to a place where you can remember the possibility. And that takes you into different areas. So the positive choice can mean being curious rather than cynical.
Yes.
Or being incredulous rather than doubtful.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's always the glass half full choice.
Totally. Yeah.
And when you start that way, it takes you to other places. When you start at the end of the song, you have nowhere to go. When the beginning of it is the same sentiment of, you have to get to, "Now life has killed the dream I dreamed."
Yeah.
You have to get there. So Jerry Zaks taught me that.
Wow.
And that's amazing.
I will be forever grateful to him.
And you've worked with Nathan Lane twice?
Yes.
Is that right? Once, and on an amazing recording of Do Re Mi.
Isn't that a charming recording?
So good. You guys are so good on that.
I love working with him. He's another one who's so alive, and he's so right there for you, and it's just like a great tennis match.
Yeah.
And here's a great Nathan story. When we were doing Laughter on the 23rd Floor, Mike Nichols and Diane Sawyer went up to his dressing room. We all knew that they were out there, and went up to his dressing room, and then after they left, Nathan came down to my dressing room, and he said, "You know, Mike Nichols and Diane Sawyer were just in my dressing room, and they just offered me a movie, and that movie was Birdcage.
Wow. Wow.
I was the first person to know that Nathan Lane was going to be in Birdcage.
That's so cool.
And then we worked together in Do Re Mi, and you know, as long as there's a mutual respect between you and Nathan, everything's fine. If there's not a mutual respect, it can be tough.
Got it.
Because he's tough on people that he works with. He demands a lot.
How do you create a show in a rehearsal room when there's cameras everywhere? Which was Moon Over Buffalo.
Yeah.
Which is more, I think the documentary has had a longer life than the play.
That's right.
Moon Over Broadway?
Yeah.
Is it? Yeah.
Yes.
Moon Over Broadway. I tell everybody I know, if you want to go into show business, please make sure you watch this documentary first. Because it's about backstage and it's also about how unkind the business can be. Hmm. I was very aware of the cameras, so I was a good girl.
Yeah.
There was a point. What happens, though, is when you're in the heat of something, like in the movie, there's that argument between Phil Bosco and Tom Moore. When you're in the heat of the moment, you forget. You literally forget that they're there. And it winds up on film.
Yeah. Wow.
And I tried to make myself, in watching this, I tried to make myself really conscious of what I said. It broke my heart because when the documentary came out and they were saying unkind things about her and how dare they, because she was the reason people were coming.
That's right.
And if you hire Carol Burnett, you can't expect her to be Marion Seldes or Eva Le Gallienne or some great Dom. You're going to get Carol Burnett.
Yeah. Right.
So that's why you're hiring her. So let her do her thing. And all through rehearsal, they were trying to get her to be what she wasn't. And that's all in the documentary. And and then when she did her first preview and she did her thing.
Yeah.
And the audience went crazy. And it's all in the documentary. They say to her, just keep doing what you're doing. Keep doing what you're doing.
Now.
But it broke my heart. Because the first time I saw the documentary, I was sitting with her, and she just grabbed my hand.
Oh, with her. Oh.
And she said, I had no idea they felt that way about me. And it was horrible. And and at subsequent screenings, when people would talk, I would defend her.
Yes.
And really go after the director and the writer for saying those things when they know full well that you hire Carol Burnett, you're going to get Carol Burnett.
Indeed.
Yeah. And then one of my favorite actors, Philip Bosco.
Mm.
What's it like working with him?
He's never acting. You can never catch him acting. You can never catch him acting. I mean, I had that scene with him on the balcony where he was drunk. It was like working with a drunk.
Yeah.
Wow. I had no idea he was acting. I thought, Phil hit the sauce before this.
He's method.
He's an incredible actor.
Wow.
I was just watching Working Girl, and he plays the boss in that, and he's so good in that.
Comedy, drama, classics, just versatile.
He does it all.
And you're right, he's like Spencer Tracy. You never catch them acting. Well, actually, before we go off Moon Over Buffalo, is there anything that you've learned in watching either Mr. Bosco or Miss Burnett that you now pass on to your students? Mm. Any little lessons that were gleaned?
The work ethic, that you must have a great work ethic. And respect for what you do and respect for everything that came before you because you wouldn't be here if they weren't here. Especially the younger people who grow up in the entitled generation, they think they can become stars overnight because of what they see on television.
Right.
So there's a work ethic that's missing, and that a little bit of kindness goes a long way. And that really is the most important. Don't be a jerk.
Yeah.
Just if you're a jerk, nobody's going to want to play with you.
True. Be gracious, yeah.
Be gracious. And Carol, whenever we would walk out on the street and she had her sunglasses on, anyone who came up to her, she always took her sunglasses off and looked them right in the eye. I learned that lesson. Just kindness, small acts of kindness.
And by the way, I love that you go from musical to play to musical.
Thank you.
That's amazing. Because a lot of different styles of music.
I'm very lucky. Yeah. I'm lucky Cole that Porter. Way. That people
Was that a conscious choice on your end to say, you know, I don't only want to do...
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, it takes a while, especially after Les Mis, it takes a while for them to see you as an actor. Because when they just hear you singing all the time, they think that's all you can do. I went out for my very first pilot season right after Les Mis. Mm-hmm. And remember Murphy Brown, the show?
Oh, yeah, I love Murphy Brown.
I went and I auditioned for a role in Murphy Brown, and the casting director looked at my resume, at that time was mostly musicals, and said, I see you've done mostly musicals. Have you ever acted before? And I said, this was a typical response.
Yeah,
so I didn't get defensive. I said, well, I am an actress, And if you give me a chance to read, I will prove that to you. That's what I said. And I read, and I got called back. I didn't get the job because I was too young. But that's the line.
A little stigma. Yeah.
Good for that, you.
Yes, stigma. Yes. There's a bit of a stigma, so you kind of have to break through that. But Les Mis did open some doors just because of how, just the size
the
of
scope,
it.
Scope,
High Society?
We didn't last very long, but there were some beautiful songs in it, and in particular, my solo called "He's a Right Guy," which Paul Gemignani and I developed together, and it was his idea to slow it down and make it a song for Liz, because it was originally sung. I think the producer Lauren Mitchell found it, and Lauren Mitchell I know from the L.A. company of City of Angels. Oh. She played Alora, and I know her from even before that, from 1977 or something like that. We were in non-equity Dinner Theater Godspell together, but the song "He's a Right Guy" was originally recorded by Ethel Merman. He's a right guy. So that's what it originally sounded like, and it was somebody's idea, maybe Paul Gemignani, to just slow it down. Mm. So we worked on that together, and it's a beautiful song that no one ever does.
When did a class act enter into your
class
life?
A class act happened through Lonnie Price, my dear friend Lonnie Price. Actually, Marty Bell said, there's this show that we like you. We're going to do a reading down at Musical Theater Works, and we'd love for you to do it. I'm going to send you a cassette of Ed Kleban singing this song called "The Next Best Thing to Love," and I think you need to hear the song. And I heard the song and said, I'll do it. Based on the song.
Really? Just on the song alone?
Just based on the song. And Lonnie. I trusted Lonnie.
Sure, of course.
And so we did a little reading with Peter Scolari as Ed.
Oh.
And then later went on to do it at Manhattan Theater Club, where they auditioned a bunch of people, and they couldn't find... And Lynn Meadows secretly wanted Lonnie to play Ed the whole time.
Really?
So another gem, no one ever sings "Next Best Thing to Love."
Great.
And
no, it's not a great one.
Gorgeous song.
And you played Sophie?
Sophie.
And who was Sophie in Ed Kleban's life?
I don't know if it's a fictional character or not. And I should know this, but it was a long time ago, so I don't remember. Mm. But Eddie was Sophie's friend. They had a romantic relationship. But she was the one who always called him on his shit.
Yeah.
Excuse me. But she was the one who always called him on his stuff. And she was not in show business like everybody else in his life, so she could be totally honest with him.
Did you meet any of Ed Kleban's family? Were they involved on this?
Well, his his girlfriend, Linda Cohen, who wrote the play with Lonnie... She was around all the time.
She was around. Is the song still part of your act, "The Next Big Thing to Love"? Do you ever get that?
I haven't done it in... I'm not able to do it in Made in Brooklyn because it wasn't written. Ed wasn't born in Brooklyn, so it wasn't...
Of course.
Doesn't fit the format, but I've sung it other times.
Other venues. Oh, you do it beautifully.
Thank you.
So many nice clips of you doing it.
Thank you.
Fiddler.
Yeah.
Golda
and Fiddler. You come full...
Full circle with that.
Full circle with that.
What a beautiful production.
I
was completely rocked by that production.
Oh, thank
just
you.
Truly, yeah.
I'm so
setting,
happy
David
to hear
Laveau
you say
was,
that.
Oh, gosh.
And Alfred
really
Molina.
I'll never forget seeing the clip that of the hit. Tradition on the awards show. And the passion. I never felt like it was so... contemporary, in the act, it wasn't, because sometimes traditional musical theater you can be, I don't know, in my young state, but it was so visceral and real, and it was so moving.
A little bit controversial, if
a
I
little.
I mean, if I remember
a
correctly.
Little, and it's all just such nonsense. Because they said that our show wasn't Jewish enough. I always wondered why, because not everybody in the show is Jewish. Truth be told, we had the same amount of Jewish people in our show that they had in the original company, which was told to me by Jerry Bach.
Mm-hmm. Good sources.
Why wasn't it Jewish
someone
enough?
Someone had to count how many Jews is in a show. I mean,
it
come
wasn't,
on.
It was nonsense, and it wasn't shticky. It wasn't like all of the other shows. There was nothing shticky about it. I mean, we I played it like a real person, and Fred most definitely played him like a real person. So he got into trouble. I guess people who think being Jewish is like being on the Upper West Side and ordering at Zabar's, that's what we're supposed to sound like. And so we took a lot of heat from that. The times, all the other reviews were really good, and boy, did our audiences love it.
Oh, yeah.
Our audiences went crazy for it. But it's the same thing. I saw the show now, and it is beautiful. And I went with all the ghosts, and we all sat there and watched it together. And there were things that I missed from our show, and there were new things that I saw, and I thought, wow, I thought it was beautiful. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing shticky about it. They're not getting in trouble for it.
What's it like working with Alfred Molina and your brilliant director, David Laveau?
Well, first, Alfred Molina, everybody who knows Alfred calls him Fred, has spoiled me rotten. He's my favorite leading man. Hmm. And I keep trying to get him to do another show together. Let's do a play together. Let's do something together. Please, let's do something together. He has spoiled me for life. We just have a great chemistry, and we're good friends. And it was from the first audition that we had that chemistry.
They brought you guys in together to...
Well, the first audition, Fred was there. He was behind the panel with everybody else. And I sang. We didn't have to sing from Fiddler. I sang a ballad. I sang a torch song, actually, because I didn't want to, a Cy Coleman torch song.
Oh. Mm.
I didn't want to show them the funny, because everybody knows that Golda is funny. Yeah, yeah. But that second half of her second act is very dramatic with all the loss. So I thought, I'm going to sing a song about loss. Wow. So I sang something written by Cy that nobody knew, because it's a Trung song, called Come Summer, written by him and Carolyn Lee. Mm. And Fred later confided in me that he wanted me to play Golda right after I sang that song.
That's great.
And then at the callback, we were just asked to read with Fred. And Fred and I had a great chemistry. And then because David was just David, he needed to see it one more time. But it was very informal. I just met with him in a room and we read together just to solidify it with him.
Sure.
David just inspires. He comes and he gives you... He doesn't talk. We talk a little bit about the scene, but then he doesn't block. He lets you find your way around.
Oh, wow.
And for instance, in the last scene where Golda has to come on and tell Tevye that Chava is married and was married by a priest, he said, "You come from there and you come from there and just do it as you feel it."
The trust.
Well, yeah.
The trust. I'm telling you, it's the trust. And the thing about David is, he says, being in our world, the minute you walk through the door, he knows if you're in his world or not.
Yeah.
There was someone who auditioned before me who was devastated when she came out because she was cut off. And she was an experienced, been around actress, and she was cut off. And I later learned from Kevin Stice that David, he just knows, he's very intuitive, and he just intuits right away if you're in the world or not.
Wow, that's incredible.
So
he created a great world.
Yeah, boy, did he create a great world.
That's really great.
One last question for you, and then we'll let you go. The Tigers Come at Night. So many students have asked, what exactly does that mean? So let me ask you, what does that mean?
I don't know. I mean, I kid a little bit, but you can't take it literally, and I also think it has something to do with the translation.
Yeah.
It's the tigers come at night with their voices soft as thunder. It's all the boys wooing you who are just going to leave you. They come at night with their voices soft as thunder. I mean, they're whispering into your ear, but ultimately they're going to devastate you.
Thank you. That just answered, I think, so many
students'
questions.
You can't take it literally.
Yeah.
But like tigers, because tigers pounce.
That's right.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to get literal about it.
Oh. Well, thank you. I feel smarter.
I do too, because I never said that out loud.
We have been talking to the delightful Randy Graff. Please check out soon her, Jackie Mason, will be doing Cymbeline together. So make sure you catch that and her club act. Don't forget, please, check us out on our Facebook, Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends.
And on Instagram at Behind the Curtain.
And on Twitter at Broadway Curtain. We have a lot of social media, and we have one follower. It's my mom, and she loves it. So. Randy, thank you so much.
Thank you. Till next time.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.